Hello, it's Friday, 10th of May. I'm Hannah Pearson. As we speed towards the middle of the year, Gary Bowman and I will review our top 10 travel wish list for 2024 and see what's changed. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So we're speeding ever faster towards the second half of the year, and we thought it was a good time to take a look back to our top 10 travel and tourism wishes, expectations, and forecasts that we made all that way back in January. Seems like a long, long time ago. So this is our 2024 travel wish list revisited. Hannah, how have those expectations measured up, or haven't they? Where should we start?
Let's go in the same order that we talked last time, and let's start. And this is really, I know, been one of your bugbears, Gary, one of both of ours, the word revenge travel and removing revenge travel from the industry's vocabulary. How are we getting on with that?
I think pretty well, actually. I think, you know, there's still, obviously, the industry is still looking backwards to 2019 rather than forwards. That's just inevitable because we're such a metric-based industry. But the term revenge travel, I don't get asked about it as much in interviews anymore. You know, the same concept is still there. Are Chinese travelers returning in the same level? You know, when will we get back to the same level of Chinese travelers as 2019? But the actual term revenge travel, I'm not hearing it so much. What about you?
I feel like you don't really come across it anymore, except in the context of there was revenge travel last year or in 2022. But 2024, it doesn't seem to be a thing. So looks like we got that one kind of right, as in terms of a wish list or things that might happen.
Yeah, I would agree. Still, it's pretty much a 2022 term, isn't it? Still used in 2023, but in 2024, I think it's gone into the background.
Hooray. So next, visa waivers being the next battleground. I think this one's still got relevance, doesn't it?
Well, this is an interesting one, isn't it? Because at the end of last year, the end of 2023, we saw this real ramping up of visas sort of being a battleground. We saw Thailand, Singapore, Malaysia offering visa-free access for Chinese travelers. China surprised the world by rolling out visa-free access to sort of hand-picked countries around the world. But we kind of thought that there would be more developments in the first half of the year than there perhaps has been. What would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I was looking back through my notes about what has happened in the first half of the year. And of course, you know, we had that big news that confirmed that, you know, Thailand had this permanent visa waiver now between Thailand and China. In the past week, we've seen Thailand sign a mutual visa exemption with Kazakhstan. They have decided to extend that visa exemption for Indian tourists and Taiwanese tourists as well, Taiwan. But you're right. You know, we have not seen anything other than kind of extensions or things that were kind of in the works already. I don't think we've seen anything dramatic, have we? We've not seen, for example, Indonesia say, hey, we're going to go visa-free. Or Laos or some of these other countries, that there's been very small measures, but nothing that has been a massive game changer that's completely new, I'd say, this year.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think probably because of something we said beforehand is the first quarter of the year usually is quite strong for tourism numbers. This year, probably stronger than, well, certainly stronger than last year, perhaps, you know, met expectations for a lot of destinations around the region. Perhaps they didn't see that it was such a priority. Maybe in the second half of the year, if this growth slowdown that we're tending to see a little bit at the moment, where if that continues, maybe there'll be a, you know, an knee-jerk reaction and people will go back towards visa waivers. But I'm not convinced. I have to admit, it's kind of changed my mind. I thought it would be a stronger battleground, as we discussed, but it hasn't really proved to be that case. I guess, you know, a lot of interest will be on what China does. And, you know, China made these grand statements about the countries, particularly in Europe, where it was offering visa-free access. And that was on a year pilot. Most of those have now been extended to a second year to the end of 2025. And we thought that maybe China would, you know, have another big announcement with another tranche of visa-free entry into the country. But it's been doing, you know, sort of individual deals with countries like Georgia. You know, Xi Jinping has been in Europe this week. But there hasn't been these grand announcements. Maybe those are to come as well. Maybe the second half of the year is when we're going to see more action on this. I'm not too sure, Hannah. But I have to say, I'm a little bit surprised the first half of the year hasn't been more proactive on the visa front.
Yeah, it's just been a lot of talk. Like Thailand prime ministers hope to have what that Schengen style visa for ASEAN that we've talked about before. But I think a lot of these things are still quite a way off. So speaking of ASEAN, that probably leads us nicely to the third point on our list from January, which was create an ASEAN standard for tourist arrivals as distinct from visitor arrivals. Gary, has anything changed for this one, do you think?
I think we were very, very hopeful with this. And I think we basically have filed this in the drawer of never going to happen. It would be great, wouldn't it? It would be good that you could actually benchmark each country on their pure tourist arrivals, not just the number of visitors, because as we know, a lot of countries in the region have quite strong immigration for labor pools, particularly Malaysia is a good example for that, Singapore too. You know, so in Malaysia in particular, there was that mix up last year where, you know, inbound numbers weren't just tourists, they were all arrivals. And a lot of that was migrant labor. So yeah, it would be great if we could have this benchmark where you could more clearly differentiate the tourist arrivals between countries, but nah, not going to happen.
The dream. On to number four then, extreme weather events hitting travel as hard as COVID. And I would say for this, we have definitely seen extreme weather this year. Have they hit quite as hard as COVID? Not yet. No. We talked about just in the last month, didn't we, about Mount Ruang, the volcano in Indonesia, disrupting flights in Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore a little bit. Of course, we had that Dubai extreme rain, which whilst not in the region, still impacted the region. Even Changi Airport last week had, 65% of Singapore's average May rainfall on one day, which saw, you know, a bunch of flights out of Changi Airport delayed, baggage handling disrupted as well, lightning warnings, Philippines warning, they're going to get into this red alert lightning strike season again, which has this massive impact on flight delays and everything. And of course, that extreme heat that we have seen plus haze. But I would say overall, has it had the impact that COVID has? I mean, it would take a lot to reach that level, but certainly we are seeing an impact.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think also, you know, when it comes to extreme weather, we're only halfway through May, and, you know, the seasonal patterns of weather, it will impact later in the year anyway. Particularly this year, we have this crossover between, El Nino and La Nina. And, you know, that can have an impact as well in terms of changing weather patterns. You know, how will global heating impact that crossover between those two different weather and temperature systems this time than it did, you know, the last time? What was that, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago? Hard to know. I mean, it's hard to predict. Meteorologists seem to come out with different forecasts, you know, all the time. But clearly, as you said, Hannah, these events do happen all the time. Their impacts become stronger each time that they happen. And, you know, we're still early through the year in that sense, I would say.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and it is, of course, that kind of longer term impact, that media impact, that seeing the haze or seeing volcanoes or whatever it is, extreme heat, then potentially puts off prospective tourists who are thinking about coming that same time next year. So it may well be that the effects might not be seen to next year or the year after, as it just keeps building and building. We're in May, still a way to go yet.
So number five, Hannah, originally, I think this was one of your selections, and this was more accurate data on the Seydou sustainability gap for Asian travelers. Huge topic, huge issue. And have we really plugged the gap?
No, not really. So this was all about this Focusrite study that was released at the end of last year that, you know, I think we talked about it then, just had a very smart way basically of asking tourists about how much they cared around sustainability and then what they actually did and what they actually booked for sustainability in a way that didn't lead to that kind of inherent bias that a lot of studies do have. But, you know, it's not looking great. So Booking.com released a study about sustainability about a month ago. And I have managed to find the full version. So readers, if you have got access, find me and ping it my way. But the stats that they did have for Singapore were kind of a little bit depressing. So 34% of Singapore tourists said they are tired of hearing about climate change all the time. And 42% said the environmental damage is irreversible and their travel choices will not make any change. I mean, of course, you've got the standard 80% say sustainable travel is important to them, but 50% still say sustainable travel is important, but it's not a primary consideration. So we are still a very long way away, I think, from understanding those motivations, particularly for APAC travelers around sustainability and tourism.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I've been working, doing some research on responsible shopping and attitudes in Asia towards responsible and sustainable shopping. And it's pretty similar. You'd be surprised. I mean, consumer brands have more access to consumers, so they can push their sustainability credentials much more strongly and much more regularly. And you would think that that would have an impact. But I think it's quite similar in the sense that there is a little bit of this fatigue that, you know, what is really happening? How do we be sustainable? You know, does it matter if we cheat every now and again? Do we have to be, you know, sustainable the whole time? What is sustainable travel? What does sustainable consumerism actually mean in the current context? How will it change in future? We're getting nowhere near that. And that, you kind of wonder now whether this is something that probably has to come from governments, because private sector travel brands, private sector consumer brands, how much are they actually bought into making life more sustainable? I mean, you know, we there's one side where there's the greenwashing, there's the other side where, you know, some brands are trying to do good work. There's no doubt about that. I'm not dismissing that. But how much is this buy-in actually to protect the world? It has to come down to governmental level. It has to come down to educational of young people. I really don't see how there's going to be much change. I think it's quite hard to change the attitudes of millennials and older people longer term. I really think that's going to be very, very difficult to do.
Young people are the future. But yeah, it's really tricky, isn't it? So as always, watch this space. Let's see. But I would love to see a really good survey, a good study on this say-do gap for sustainability, in particular for APAC travelers, because I think there's so much focus, as we said before, on what Western travelers see and do. And of course, it is a lot easier to be sustainable in a Western country when you have recycling and all of these policies institutionalized, and not necessarily the case in many countries in APAC.
I agree with that, Hannah. And I think also, particularly in this region, you know, whatever your stance is as a young person or a millennial or whatever age group on more sustainable living, when you see that your government is really promoting tourism so heavily on a numbers-based criteria of getting more travelers, increasing tourism as an economic value, you know, you are naturally going to wonder, where does sustainability, where does the environment come into this equation? And I think that's, you know, until that changes, it's going to be very, very hard to get much more buy-in from younger people.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, as we've said before, the elephant in the room is flights, isn't it? And we've talked about SAF, and I saw some strong comments about SAF on our LinkedIn page from Stephen Grace. And is it just we don't fly? Is it just that we don't travel? Is that the solution? You know, big questions for a Friday afternoon. So let's move on. But there's, yeah, so much to talk about, so much to think about. It's a big, big topic, sustainability. Yeah,
I think we file that one for our travel wish list in 2025 and see where we've got to in 6 months' time. I guess I'm really not sure we've actually achieved anything so far this year.
No. Right, number six, and this is one of your picks, Gary, I think still holds true now. Let's stop lionizing AI in travel and tourism.
No, we've gone nowhere with that. In fact, we've gone backwards, haven't we? Absolutely everything. The whole travel media agenda at the moment is about AI and how this is going to change the way people travel, the way travel companies work, you know, the whole travel ecosystem. And, well, we haven't really seen that it is doing that. We've seen no evidence yet. We do know that it's changing the operation and the processing, the way that companies actually work. You know, it's making them more effective, if that data is good enough to make them more effective, but it's certainly reducing the human input into many things in travel. Is it changing the way consumers perceive and travel? I mean, that's a big question. We're too early in that journey, I think. Yeah, and the tools that are being rolled out at the moment aren't really that transformative. You know, a lot of the AI tools are in things like trip planning, and trip planning itself is pretty controversial around the world at the moment. There's a lot of different views about how effective trip planning tools actually are with or without AI, and how much people actually want to use them. So I would say that the media onslaught in terms of the PR is still going on, but the actual effects of AI to be proven, I think.
I think that's a great summary. And for anyone who wants to see AI trip planning in action and it being torn apart, I suggest you follow Stuart McDonald, who's been a long time guest of the show, who put together a very recent, I think, study of all of these different tools putting together an itinerary in Indonesia with the results that you might expect. Not very successful.
Absolutely. So let's move on to number seven, Hannah. We're rattling through our list here. This is our top 10 travel wish list for 2024 that we put together back in January. We're revisiting where we are in the middle of May. And number seven on our list, Hannah, was domestic tourism, which we talk about a lot. Domestic destinations, putting the investment to revitalize themselves. Where are we with that?
You know, I don't think we've got anywhere with that one either. I mean, unless you've seen something that I haven't, I don't feel that there have been any big groundbreaking moves to incentivize domestic tourism, to promote domestic tourism. It's been a lot of talk, but I think, again, no action. And even if you look at a country like Vietnam, there's been a lot of press recently about how it's much cheaper to fly overseas instead of traveling domestically in Vietnam because of high airfares. For domestic routes. So in that sense, perhaps we've even gone a little bit backwards. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think, and also the price rises, the return of international travel into domestic arenas has pushed up hotel rates. It's pushed up everything, hasn't it? The cost of travel. I mean, I was reading a good example in Japan, for example, and the growth rates of hotel rooms in the three major cities, Tokyo, Osaka, and Kyoto, have gone really, really high now. And that, you know, that it's expensive for Japanese travelers to go to those destinations now. So they're looking at cheaper destinations around the region. I think the same has happened here in Malaysia, hasn't it, Hannah? A lot of Malaysians, for example, are going overland into Thailand because destinations here like Langkawi just jacked up their rates. And, you know, the hotel industry will always say, well, it's supply and demand. But in many cases, it's not. It's yield management. It's actually pushing up the rates when the demand actually isn't there. And, you know, that worked really, really well during that honeymoon period post-pandemic. But if you listen to Jesper from STR CoStar, you know, he's talking a lot now in his presentations around the region of how ADR growth rates are starting to slow down. Is that a result of the fact that they've just overpriced and priced out domestic travelers? It could be that. And the same as you're saying in Vietnam, we've seen that with the airfares, particularly to destinations like Phu Quoc, just becoming too expensive for at a time when, you know, inflation has hurt budgets of domestic travelers. The cost of living has gone up. The cost of travel is going up. Everything is going up. People are a little bit more reticent to make that spend, particularly when they're traveling in their own destinations. And, you know, where's the support to actually promote people to travel locally?
Definitely missing. But hey, again, we're halfway through the year. And as you say, Gary, you know, the first quarter, first half of the year tends to be a little bit higher. And then as we move into Q3, reality starts to bite a little bit more. Perhaps then we're going to see more of the return of a focus on domestic tourism to plug those gaps. This, again, probably leads nicely to one of your points, which was from last time, greater focus on the weekend economy versus a weekday economy. And there are plenty of gaps there, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. And, you know, I think we overlay that with something we always talk about, Hannah, you know, the public holiday economy, which is so important to travel and tourism, particularly, as you said, in that first quarter of the year, the public holidays really stimulate travel demand. But the weekend economy has been very, very strong as well for long weekend holidays. The weekday economy, it's starting to return because you are seeing business travel much livelier than it was 12 months ago, for sure, and certainly than it was 24 months ago. You know, again, there's that growing weakness in ADR growth rates that suggests that business travel perhaps is not as strong as it was pre-pandemic, and perhaps business travelers aren't staying for as long as they did before. I mean, again, you know, we don't have the full year's data to actually be able to justify what's happening in 2024. 2024 generally is going to be a very, very different year to 2023, which itself was a very, very different year to 2022. So I guess in that sense, Hannah, making any you know, statements about what's actually happening, is it's still early in the game, as we're saying for most of our points on this list. We're not quite halfway through the year. I guess we have to get the full year's data.
Yeah, exactly. I agree 100%. Next up was one of my picks, which was a greater scrutiny and fact-checking from the media. And I think this was me last year just being driven crazy by that study you were talking about, Gary, this Malaysia tourism one that was picked up. And was it tourist arrivals? Was it border crossings? What was it? And everybody printing it and nobody bothering to check. And yeah, it drove me nuts. I haven't spotted anything that has been really, that has really stood out to me, I think, over the last few months that has been really misreported or covered incorrectly on the whole. But, you know, still, I would just love to see more questioning around general strategies or governments rolling out new things and you saying, yeah, but how does that fit with the other thing that you talked about a month or so ago? You know, greater holding people to more a sense of accountability. It's not always an easy thing with the press here in Southeast Asia, and I acknowledge that.
Yeah, and I would also say, Hannah, that, and this is nothing to do with the media, they're not culpable in any way here, is you're starting to see quite a lot of posts on LinkedIn and Facebook, but more LinkedIn, where you're seeing lists or data sets related to destinations or related to travel numbers, which are drawn, sorry, you may understand that AI is a bit of a bugbear for me, but are drawn from AI tools. And they're just posted liberally. And there's no fact-checking about whether these are actually correct. And in many instances, they're not. But you're seeing this and they get shared and they get liked and they get commented about. And people are liking and commenting something that actually just isn't true. And you wonder, like, is this really where we're going now? Is it actually going to be a case that, you know, nobody's actually bothering to actually check whether the data that we're using in our lives is valid?
Scary, isn't it? That's the AI fake news, all of this stuff, increasingly polarized world. So scary, but lesson to everybody, go check the facts. If it looks too good to be true, if it looks a little bit strange, question them, challenge them, go and check. Most of this data is publicly available. You know, it's not hidden away. It's on a government website somewhere. Go check it out yourself and see if it's actually true before you publish it or you share it.
A good point on that, Hannah, actually coming back to something that we've said on the podcast many, many times, is when we do our reviews of the month or the quarter of the arrivals figures across the region, and you stated this very, very clearly many times, not everybody reports at the same time. So if you're saying online, on the podcast, you know, well, hang on, certain country we don't yet have February's figures, or this country we have right up to date because they publish very, very regularly, then that's clear and that's stating the actual situation. But if you're an AI tool just going and scraping from these data sites, you're not comparing on that basis that, you know, perhaps one country is missing February and one country is actually reported up to date, another country has yet to report its January figures or something like that. And therefore, you know, that's where scraping becomes very, very difficult because there's no context to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So do your homework before you share, please.
So after a rather grumpy rant there, let's move on to number 10 on our list, Hannah, which is some good news. Well, we hope it's good news. It's moving towards very, very positive news. This is in Thailand. Tell us a little bit more and where we are right now.
Yeah, so this, we called it a diversity boost for Thai tourism. But essentially, that Thailand is set to be the first Southeast Asian country to legalize same-sex marriage. At the beginning of the year, it had got through a few stages. It has now been approved by the House of Representatives and the Senate. Still got a little bit way further to go, but it looks pretty much a done deal. And in fact, you know, couples have already registered to be the first ones, you know, to be able to register their marriage on the day that it finally goes live and into law. So it's fantastic. I mean, and Thailand, you know, already, I think about a month ago, the Department of Trade Strategy of the Ministry of Commerce has been urging the government to make Thailand a hub for all gender weddings in Asia. That's what they called it. So, you know, they're smart. We know that Thailand will get that PR machine into full swing as soon as this is a done deal. And rightly so.
Yeah, absolutely. 100% agree. I was reading the latest reports that this will probably become law if it jumps all the following hurdles by the end of the year. And then, as you said, Hannah, this has a huge boost, diversity boost for inbound tourism, but also domestic tourism as well. We could see a real transformation of that all-gender travel, as you said, Hannah. This will be terrific for the region. It can't happen soon enough.
Yeah, absolutely. So with that positive news as a perhaps a contrast to some of the gloomier stories that we've had. That brings the show to a close for this week. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. And of course, don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments on anything we discussed or anything we missed out. You can drop us a message on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Yep. And as always, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, the seasiatravelshow.com. And you can find us on any international podcast platform.
So that's a wrap for today, but we'll be back soon to talk more Southeast Asia travel and tourism. See you then.